that you have just heard read. We have a quotation from one of my favorite psalms. I have 150 favorite psalms, and this is one of them. It's the second psalm. And I want us to do some studying in that psalm tonight. In fact, that's going to be the basis of our study. And before I get into the lesson, I want to say a word or two. I appreciate being invited here again. I appreciate the elders inviting me here. And I don't know, it seems that something has conspired to keep me and Mo from being together very much. The first meeting that I was here, due to the fact of the death of his father and so on, he wasn't able to be here but just the very tail end of that. It just seems like there's been something, but I enjoy being with Mo. I find him one of the most pleasant men I ever deal with. I wouldn't have to say that. I want Mo to know that. I'm not saying that just to make a point, because if I didn't feel that way, I could just keep quiet about it. You'd never know. Dealt with, and I enjoy, but I just want him to know in front of you how much I appreciate him. And I love this church. I love this congregation. I love you people. If you could be here for so many of the people that I've known and loved, I wish they could be here forever, but we can't be here forever. There's another place where the forever is going to be. So that means there are going to be some times here in life and on earth where we're going to be separated from those that we wish we could hold on to. But that day will come for all of us. But we have joy as we contemplate that, because we have a building from God, a house not made with hands. But now then, let's look at this marvelous psalm, the second psalm. And even though the second psalm does not have an inscription saying Psalm of David, as many of the psalms do have, we know that David wrote this psalm because in Acts 4 and verse 25, the apostles, as they praised God on that occasion, referred to David as the writer of that psalm. So we know that David did write this psalm. David, the ancestor of Christ, and not just an ancestor, but as the near ideal king that ruled over God's people, he became a sort of a type of Christ and is used in the prophets numerous times as a type of Jesus. So it is a very significant psalm. So think about the psalm. Now, as we look at the psalm, realize it has four little sections. How convenient. Four little sections of three verses each. Okay? Why do the nations rage, and the peoples imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us cast their cords away, let us break their bands asunder. He that sitteth in the heavens will laugh. The Lord will have them in derision. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said unto me, thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. Ask of thee, and I will give thee the nations for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore be wise, O ye kings. Be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and ye perish in the way, for his wrath will soon be kindled. Blessed are all they that take refuge in him. The first three verses describe the nations or the heathen in a tumult. Why do the nations rage? And the idea is of a bubbling ferment. There's a tumult as the nations are like an ocean with the waves just sweeping and tossing back and forth. Every generation of men that has ever been has been a crooked and perverse generation so far as God is concerned. Men have consistently gone astray from God, and they have worked their own wills instead of God's will. And they think that they are thwarting the will of God. And so it continues to be even to the present day. Men do not think God is in charge. And even if they do think He is in charge, they are determined to resist Him and to overthrow His will. So the nations rage. The peoples imagine a vain thing. The vain thing they contemplate is the idea of thwarting the will of God. It cannot be done. It is in vain. And they say, let us cast His cords away. We're not going to be restrained by God. We will go our own way. We will do our own thing. And we will not regard what God has to say. And what the nations do not understand is that they have no choice, really, in being subject to the will of God. In other words, the will of God is going to be done. And the nations have a place in that will of God. If the nations or those of the nations submit unto His will, then they can be saved. But those nations that do not submit to His will suffer oblivion. They will suffer the judgment of God. But the Lord is not intimidated by the nations. He that sitteth in the heavens will laugh. I like to put it this way. You and I may walk the floor sometimes, but God never does. I'm glad God does not walk the floor. And God does not ever wring His hands, as I might, or you might. He is not intimidated by the nations of men. And He will bring His plan to pass. And at this point, I want to tell you what that will is. Because, you know, I get the feeling that sometimes, as we think about us preachers saying that, oh, God is going to win, God is accomplishing His will, we look around us and say, isn't that pretty well preacher talk? Because you look at how many of the world today, how much of the world is given over to unbelief today? The overwhelming percentage of the world is given to unbelief today. And we look at these things and we say, poor God. And it is not poor God. It is poor nations, poor men, because let me tell you what the will of God is. In every generation, the will of God is to cast His net out and save from all the nations of the earth those who will. Whether it be China, through the last quite number of years, China has done many, many things to stop the preaching of the gospel. And the preaching of the gospel has had to go on in a very careful manner in China. There's been persecution, but there have been saints converted in China. And whether it's Australia, whether it's Japan, whether it's Russia, wherever it is, God casts His net and He sends the gospel out to be preached. And those in any nation that respond to that gospel are saved, and God's will is done, and the nation, whatever nation it may be, cannot stop God from doing that. And you know, you and I say, yeah, but there are so few. Well, yes, there are few. And the Bible throughout acknowledges there are few. When the world was destroyed in the days of its incredible wickedness through the flood, there were few that were saved. That is, 8 souls were saved. And although God is a God who would have all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth, He is not turned off and discouraged when He sees the 8 that are faithful. When God sees that few saved that love Him and respond to Him, He loves them and He is satisfied. So let me tell you a way to think about this. It is not a question of whether God is going to win. It is not a question of whether God is accomplishing His desire and His will. It is not a question of does God have His holy nation. The question is, am I a part of it? That's the question that you need to ask and I need to ask. Am I a part of God's harvest? Am I a part of His success? God is accomplishing His will, and the nations cannot keep Him from doing it. So the Lord will have them in derision. Then will He speak unto them in His wrath and vex them in His sore displeasure, because He succeeds. Yet have I set my King upon my holy hill of Zion. Nowhere is this conflict between God and the nations more enhanced. Nowhere does it come more to a focus than in the time when Jesus came to the earth and offered men the final salvation of the Lord. There were those who heard Jesus and disbelieved. There were those who heard Him and would not hear any further. But there were those who heard Him and responded, and they believed, and they became followers of His. But those who did not, upon them the wrath of God comes. And you know what the judgment of the nations is? And always has been? Oblivion. Oblivion. I say oblivion because if we were to go looking for that great Egyptian empire that once enslaved Israel, where is it? If we go looking for mighty Assyria, where is it? If we were to go and want to see the stupendous capital of Assyria, Nineveh, where would we go to see it? Because even if we went and inspected the ruins, that's all they would be. And for many, many centuries, men did not even know that that pile that looked like a hillock was Nineveh. What about the great Babylon? The great city of Babylon with its hanging gardens. One of the wonders of the world. What happened to it? Where is it now? And in the days when Jesus was born into the world, the greatest and mightiest of empires up until that time ruled, and that was the Roman. Where is the Roman Empire? The nations of men, whether it was an empire or a kingdom, they have passed away. As we sing the song, the kingdoms of earth pass away one by one, and that is the judgment of God upon the nations, that the nations will forever be passing away and going into oblivion. If we determine that our hope is in the nations and we cast our lot with the nations, then we are also accepting the fate of the nations, which is oblivion and judgment before the throne of Jesus Christ. As we look at these six verses that we have considered thus far in Psalm chapter 2, I want to make the point to you that there is an enormous amount of Scripture that is explained by these passages setting forth the conflict between God and men. Men do not walk the ways of God. They will not walk in His ways. They are a crooked and perverse generation. And yet God persists and brings His will to pass. He foretells the coming of the Messianic Kingdom. He foretells the coming of the Messiah. And even when we look at the prophecies regarding the coming of the Messiah, it doesn't look very promising in some of those passages. For example, the Messiah Himself is described as one who has no personal charm, no personal beauty, and He is not great the way the world looks at it. And when we see Jesus come upon this earth, there is nothing in Him, in His own person, to make people think, hey, look at this fellow. Look how educated he is. Look how wealthy he is. Look at how much earthly power he has. He had none of those things. Nevertheless, He was the Messiah, and He did succeed in doing exactly what God sent Him to do. Let me think about a number of the passages of the Old Testament with you where this idea of the conflict between God and the nations is brought out. I'm not going to turn to all of these, but Isaiah chapter 13 through 23 is a section where God pronounces His judgments against the nations. And then in chapters 24 through 27 of Isaiah, He pronounces judgment upon the earth itself with all the nations, whatever those nations may be. And I like the fact that in Isaiah 34, You have a contrast between what's the future for Edom? The future for Edom is desolation and utter destruction. And if you ever go or ever see anything about a tour today to the land of Edom, Petra was not actually a city of the Edomites. It was a city that was built in that same area by the Nabataeans. But if you were to go and walk in that area today, unless a recent tourist has left it, you won't find a kin. You won't find... There's nothing. There's nothing. You'd walk and the wind would just sort of be blowing through there, and that's all the sound there would be, where it had been full of people. That's the future for Edom, Isaiah says. But in chapter 35, he says, there's a great future for Israel. God is going to bring Israel back. Now the same kind of thing is seen in the book of Ezekiel. And in this one you might want to turn. In Ezekiel, the children of Israel are in captivity. They're in bondage. And if you've never been in bondage before, it's hard to imagine. But it's very, very depressing, very, very discouraging. And the children of Israel were in this bondage. They've been taken away from their land. During the course of the writing of the book of Ezekiel, Jerusalem falls. And there is no more Judah. The people have all been taken captive. Now, in chapter 35, he talks about, once again, Edom. What's going to happen to Edom? Edom has no future. Desolation. That's the only future that awaits Edom. But 36, the mountains of Israel are going to blossom again. I think that's a beautiful figure. The mountains of Israel are going to bloom again. Edom's going to be a desert. Israel, the mountains are going to bloom again. But Israel's very discouraged, and they say, oh, well, I don't know if we believe that or not. I don't know. I don't know whether that can happen or not. Well, how can that be? Surely the Lord's not going to be able to do anything with us now. And so God takes Ezekiel to this valley in chapter 37. He takes him to a valley. And he takes him all over this valley. And this valley is covered with dry bones. Not just bones, but dry bones, meaning that these bones have been dead for a long time. It's not that these were carcasses just killed. These bones have lain there and been baked in the sun and dried by the wind, and the bodies of these people that died there, they have been dead for who knows how long. And God sets Ezekiel in the midst of all those bones. And try to picture yourself being Ezekiel and standing in the middle of a great big valley filled with bones. God says, Ezekiel, will these bones live again? Can that be? Ezekiel wisely said, you know, O Lord. And God said to Ezekiel, prophesy to these bones. And Ezekiel could say, as you and I could say, I've never prophesied to dead bones before. Prophesy to these bones, Ezekiel. And tell them that skin is going to come upon you and flesh and tissue, and you're going to be put together. And so Ezekiel begins to prophesy to all these dead bones, these dry bones. And then there is a sound, a rumble. There is an earthquake. Now how would you feel? Standing hip deep in dry bones. And you hear a rumble and a shaking. And you look out there and all this mass of bones is beginning to wiggle. And they're beginning to come together and hook together. And then sinews, tendons, muscle tissue begins to appear. And then the skin. But now they're all bodies, but they're lying there and they're not breathing. So God says to Ezekiel, Ezekiel, prophesy to the wind. Say to the four winds, breath, come and breathe upon these bodies. And so the wind begins to sigh and moan and blow through that whole valley over all of those bodies. And then those bodies begin to stand up. And here they are standing up, a tremendous army. where there were only dead bones, dry bones before. And God says, now Ezekiel, the house of Israel thinks that because they are dead, it is as if they're in their graves, and there is nothing I can do to bring them back, that there's nothing I can do to restore them. But this is to let you know and to let Israel know that I am the Lord and I have the power to restore. And I can restore Israel and I can bring them back and I can do the things that I have spoken of doing. And of course, the thing that God has in mind doing for Israel goes far beyond physically bringing them back to the land. Yes, he's going to bring them back physically to the land, but he's going to do far more than that. He's going to take their spiritual horizons farther than they've ever even imagined. But when he does this, there will be opposition, because look in chapter 38 now. This is chapters 38 and 39 of Ezekiel are the chapters dealing with God. Of course, when the premillennialists today get through with God, he is some kind of a, he ought to have a cape or something like that, be a, some kind of an evil superhero. When they get through with him, he is a fictional somebody. When they get, they don't get the point. But the point is rooted in the second Psalm and in that concept of conflict between God and the nations. As the nations seek to thwart the will of God, they're going to stop God from doing his will. So in chapter 38, God brings his legions against God and his people, against the unwalled cities, but God is going to be their wall. And he is going to protect them, and he's going to conquer, and does conquer Gog. So even though God brings all the numerous hosts that are his, they fail. They fail. Now listen, if you will notice, if you will take the time to notice in the first several verses of chapter 38, where it is naming the nations that are involved in Gog's army, you will see that none of them come from Shem. You have Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the three sons of Noah. None of them come from Shem. The ones that are listed come from Ham and primarily from Japheth. The reason for that is they are symbolizing the nations of men that are in opposition to God. These are the nations that are going to oppose God's will, and their destiny is going to be oblivion and destruction. And that is exactly what we see happen to them in chapter 38 and then in chapter 39. At the same time as Ezekiel, we have another great prophet, and that was Daniel. And you remember in Daniel 2, the vision that Nebuchadnezzar had. Nebuchadnezzar saw a great statue in his vision. The statue had a head of gold, the chest, shoulders of silver, the abdomen and the upper thighs of brass or bronze, and the legs of iron and the feet of iron and clay mixed. Now, as you read that closely, you will find that the idea of the legs of iron and the feet of iron and clay mixed do not represent two kingdoms. They rather represent a kingdom and an aspect of that kingdom. That though that kingdom will be a kingdom terribly strong, as iron is, yet it will also be a kingdom that will not adhere. It will be a kingdom composed of many peoples, but those peoples will not become one homogeneous people. But it will be an empire that though it is strong, there is a fragility to that kingdom. A fragility that can cause it to fall apart, because of the different people that are stuck together in it like clay and iron are. But when you get to Daniel 2 and verse 44, we have the actual interpretation and application that Daniel makes of that passage. Daniel says that you, O king, Nebuchadnezzar, you, O king, are the head of gold. Following you, there will be another kingdom. And then following that will be a third. Well, we have the Babylonian, we have the Medo-Persian, we have the Grecian or Alexandrian Empire, and then we have the fourth empire, the Roman Empire. So in chapter 2 and verse 44, Daniel says, and in the days of these kings, That's the kings of the fourth empire. The God of heaven shall set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. Now, in contrast to the kingdoms of men that will be destroyed, here is a kingdom that will never be destroyed. See that? Now, out of all the kingdoms on the earth, there is one that will never be destroyed. Every other one will be destroyed. God will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms. The sovereignty of it will not be left to another people. It will never be captured. It will never be destroyed, but in turn, it will break in pieces and consume all these other kingdoms. By the way, as you remember that idea, it will break in pieces. Let me remind you, just for a moment here, if you go back to that second psalm, listen to what he says. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said unto me, Thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. Ask of me, and I will give thee the nations for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Do you see that idea of breaking them with a rod of iron, dashing them in pieces? Is reflected in that language in Daniel 2:44. That the kingdom of the Messiah, the kingdom that God is going to set up in the days of that fourth empire, it will break in pieces and consume all these other kingdoms. One of my favorite passages, because of the irony of it, is in Micah the fourth chapter. In Micah the fourth chapter, God is saying, all the nations have gathered together to the threshing floor because they are figuring they're going to see their desire upon Zion. They think, see, the nations are all gathering together with the idea that, oh, we're finally going to get to see our desire upon Zion. And then God says, you got it wrong. You think you are coming to thresh Zion, but actually you are coming to be threshed. Isn't that interesting? And so God says there in Micah the fourth chapter, the latter part of the fourth chapter, he says, you think you're going to see your desire brought about upon Zion. You want to see it destroyed. You don't want to see the kingdom of God upon earth. And so you think you've come to do it in. No, you are the ones that are going to be done in. And another great passage on this subject. There are so many. Another great passage on this subject is Haggai chapter 2, verse 6 and verse 21. In two visions on the same day, God says, Yet once more will I shake the earth. I will shake the earth. I will shake the nations, so that the things that are removed will be made manifest, and the kingdom that cannot be moved will also be made manifest. I illustrate that idea with, imagine I had a board here and I had a lot of dominoes standing up on their ends on this board. And I told you, on one of these dominoes, there is a drop of super glue on the end of it, and I pressed it down on the board. Now, only one is like that. And so here I am holding the board, and I ask you, now you tell me which is the domino that is glued down with super glue and cannot fall. Can you tell me which one it is? No, not as long as I simply hold the board. But if I were to take that board and give it a rather violent shake like that, all of the ones that aren't stuck down would immediately fall. And the one that cannot fall would be left. And what God was saying in that message in Haggai is that he was going to make it manifest to all men which kingdoms were to be destroyed and which one was going to stand. The judgment of God has been pronounced upon the nations, and their judgment is oblivion. But his kingdom, the kingdom of the Messiah, has been established and it will never fall. And so this is the great message that we find here. And as I say, I want you to remember that as you study passages like Joel, the third chapter in the Valley of Jehoshaphat,
as you study passages like Zechariah 14 and many others, where it talks about God fighting for His people, defending His people, it's talking about this very idea of the conflict between God and men who will not accept His plan, and they're going to thwart His will, and yet they cannot. He will overcome. Now let's move on in that second psalm. In verse 7, in the second psalm, there is someone who says, I will tell of the decree. Now what I want to know is, who is that I speaking there? I will tell of the decree. Well, we can find out who that I is. He tells us. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said unto me. Now the me and the I are the same person. So when we know what the Lord said to him, then that will give us a clue. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said unto me, you are my son. So you see, now we know who the I speaking here is. He is the Son of God. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said unto me, you are my son. This day have I begotten thee. Now normally when you and I think about that idea of begotten, we think about the idea of being conceived, or the idea of being born. And yet in Acts 13 and verse 33, actually beginning in verse 32, the Apostle Paul says, we bring you good tidings of the promise made unto the fathers, that God has fulfilled the same unto our children, in that He raised up Jesus from the dead, as also it is written in the second psalm, thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. So the question immediately is, how could Paul apply the language, thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee, to the idea of the resurrection of Jesus, when you would think he would be talking about the birth? Well, it's really a fascinating idea. If you take this word, begotten, it is an extremely common word in the Hebrew language, and it means to bring forth. To bring forth. And I'm sure most often it is used to refer to the birth process. And even children are called by a derivative of that word, because they are those who have come forth. But it does mean to bring forth. Can you think of anything that God brought forth when He raised Jesus from the dead? See? Yes, He brought something forth. He brought the dead body of Jesus forth from the grave when He raised Him from the dead. And I think there's more. Because when Pilate and the Romans and the Jews that were there at that time, when they crucified Jesus, what they were telling Jesus was, you are not the Son of God. Now, would that be a fair statement to make? That the Jews at that time and Pilate and the Romans were saying to Jesus, you are not the Son of God. Now, God had on several occasions made the point that this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Remember when He was baptized? When Jesus was baptized of John, God said that. And on the Mount of Transfiguration, Matthew 17, God said that. But here were men saying to God, this is not your Son. And they were saying to Jesus, you are not God's Son. But at that very time when the world's rejection was so powerful, the affirmation of God was more powerful, because God said, yes, He is. Yes, He is my Son. And He demonstrated it to the world by raising Him from the dead and thus fulfilling the promises made unto the fathers. Thou art my Son, this day have I begotten thee. Ask of me, and I will give thee the nations for thine inheritance. Do you remember when the devil took Jesus to the top of the exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and the glories of them and said, all these things will I give thee if thou wilt fall down and worship me. Jesus already had those things promised to him. Already had them promised. The devil didn't mention anything about going through the way of the cross. God's way, the way that Jesus followed, would take Jesus to the cross. But God's way would work. And God's way did work. And the devil's way would be utter destruction and chaos. And Jesus knew, the nations are already mine. I will give thee the nations for thine inheritance. And listen, you know about the Great Commission, don't you? Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. What gave Jesus the right to say that? Because he had been given the nations of the earth for his inheritance and the uttermost parts of the earth for his possession. Teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Why could Jesus say that? Because God had given unto him the nations for his inheritance and the uttermost parts of the earth for his possession. So that promise of God and that deed that God performed was the basis of the authority given to Jesus. All authority hath been given unto me in heaven and on earth. Indeed, God set his king upon his holy hill of Zion. And he did give him the nations of the earth for his possessions. And he said, you will break them with a rod of iron. You will dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. In other words, the rule of Christ would be successful and could not be thwarted. It would be as sensible to think of the rule of Christ and the authority of Christ being thwarted as it would to think of a shelf with pottery vessels on it. And here I'm standing with my piece of reinforcement rod, and the pottery vessels are being ugly, if you can imagine that. They're being stubborn. They're resisting my will. And they persist in resisting my will, knowing that I'm going to destroy them if they do, but they persist. They think that they can withstand me. I take my reinforcement rod, and I come swinging across that shelf. Do you have any idea that one of those vessels would go, bong, and I'm just jar all over? No. That rod of iron would sweep through those vessels and reduce them to dust and pieces and particles. The rule of Jesus, we must not underestimate the power of that rule. We must not think that there is any doubt about the outcome. He already rules. The world just doesn't know it yet. If we accept that rule and bow to him in adoration and love and faith, then we rule with him. But if we do not, then we take our stand with the nations. And judgment will be the fate and oblivion for all those nations. I'm not saying oblivion for the individuals. No. Every individual will stand before the throne of Jesus Christ, who will judge the living and the dead. And God has appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained. But I'm simply saying that if you do not bow to Jesus, if you do not accept him, then listen to the warning in the last part of the song. Now therefore be wise, O ye kings, be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, and that kiss is the kiss of submission, the kiss of adoration. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and ye perish in the way, for his wrath will soon be kindled. Blessed are all they that take refuge in him. Now on this thing about you'll break them with a rod of iron. quickly, I want to mention a few things for you to think about. In Psalm 110 and verse 2, the Lord will cause the rod of His strength to go out from Zion. You think that is related? The Lord will cause the rod of His strength to go forth out of Zion. Yeah, I think that one's related. In Isaiah 11, verses 1 through 4, there shall be a shoot out of the stock of Jesse, and a branch out of his root shall bear fruit. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. And he shall not judge after the sight of his eyes, nor decide after the hearing of his ears. But with righteousness shall he judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek on the earth. And he will smite the earth with the rod of his mouth. Now that's the first place. In fact, it's about the only place in the Old Testament where that rod is defined as the rod of his mouth. In other words, this is not some literal rod. It is the word of Jesus. The word of Jesus expresses the will of Jesus, just as the word of God expresses the will of God. Therefore, it is backed by all his authority and power to make it so. That is his rod. And he will smite the earth with the rod of his mouth. Now, fast forwarding to Revelation, the 12th chapter, where we see a woman standing ready to be delivered of a child. And she is delivered of a son, a man-child, who is to rule the nations with a rod of iron. Who do you think that is? Do you see that John in Revelation 12 and verse 5 is going back here to the second psalm to identify who this man-child is? This man-child is obviously Christ. And then John writes that he was caught up unto God. Her child was caught up unto God and unto his throne. But who is he? He is the one who is to smite the earth with a rod of iron. And then in Revelation 19 and verse 15, there is described one who comes forth with a garment with blood upon it, riding a white horse, whose name is the Word. And in verse 15, out of his mouth proceedeth a sharp sword. And in that same verse, it mentions that here is the one who will smite the earth with the rod of iron. In fact, Revelation 19 and verse 15 is the only passage in all the Bible that combines the two related concepts of the rod and the sword. The sword is not mentioned in the second psalm. The rod is mentioned. But the sword is mentioned in the Old Testament in Isaiah 49 and verse 2, where Isaiah, speaking for the Messiah, says that the Lord has made him his sharp sword. He has made his mouth his sharp sword. And so when we come to John's vision in chapter 1, and verse 16, there is the Son of Man with the seven stars in his right hand, and proceeding out of his mouth is a sharp two-edged sword. In chapter 2, and about verse 11 or 12, and also in verse 16, in the letter to the church at Pergamum, two occasions, the one who is dictating these letters there is referred to as the one who has the sharp two-edged sword. So, one thing that I wanted you to see as a result of our study of this psalm is how many of the figures and the ideas that are found in the psalm are actually the basis for a great deal of the prophetic literature. How much extends even to the New Testament and concepts that are found there. So the second psalm is indeed a pivotal psalm. A comprehensive psalm, one of the great messianic psalms, telling us that here is God who had his plan, and though men opposed that plan, he brought it to pass anyhow. And that opposition was particularly focused in the day when God sent his son into the world. Here he was in the world made through him, and the world did not receive him. He came unto his own, the people that God had nurtured and cared for all along, and they that were his own did not receive him. They all rejected him. The world rejected him. The Jews rejected him. And he was killed and he was buried. But on the third day, he was raised from